Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Hello and welcome to our special festive edition of Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley. This is the show that gets Christians and non-Christians talking, brings you conversations that matter every week here on Premier Christian Radio and listen to around the world as the Unbelievable podcast. Looking forward to bringing you this very special Christmas edition of the show as I'm joined by two guests to look at the science behind the Christmas story. If you're not already subscribed to the podcast, can I encourage you to go and do that? Share it with friends, let others know. premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable, and that's also the place where you can find lots of resources, the Unbelievable app, the newsletter, DVDs, videos, articles, and much more besides. Just go there and you'll find everything you need to explore the Unbelievable universe. premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. And later on in today's show, I've got a special guest for you alongside the two who I've got in discussion today. N.T. Wright will be joining me towards the end of the program. I recently launched a special new podcast, the Ask N.T. Wright Anything podcast, with one of the world's most renowned biblical scholars, really. So one of the questions I asked him on a recent edition of it was whether we can trust the narratives, the birth narratives from Matthew and Luke, shepherds, wise men, angels, and so on. You'll hear his answer towards the end of today's program. Look forward to hearing what you had to say in response to recent shows as well. We'll be hearing some of your feedback too towards the end of today's programme. So happy Christmas and welcome to today's show. Well, we're talking about a very scientific Christmas on Unbelievable as we approach Christmas just a couple of days away. We're asking about the theories behind the Star of Bethlehem. Who were the Magi? And can a scientist believe in the miracles of Christmas, angelic visitations, the virgin birth, and so on? My two guests on the show today are Mark Kidger and Gillian Strain. Mark is an agnostic. He's an astronomer with the European Space Agency and has had a long-standing interest in the Star of Bethlehem. He's come on the show a couple of times before to talk about them. He wrote a book on the subject, The Star of Bethlehem, An Astronomer's View. And he's going to be guiding us through the many theories that exist and what he believes himself about the Star of Bethlehem and, of course, who were the Magi purportedly guided by it. Gillian Strain is our other guest on the show today, Anglican priest with a background in physics research. And her book, Introducing Science and Religion, A Path Through Polemic, seeks to show that faith and science aren't in conflict but shed light on each other. And along the way, we'll be hearing from a few children recounting the Christmas story for us. I promise it will be super cute. So welcome along to the programme. Both Gillian and Mark, great to have you with me both. You've both been on the show at one point or another before. Gillian, you were on earlier in the year talking to Alom Shaha, the author of the Young Atheists Guide. And that was to do with your more recent book on cancer and your journey through that as a scientist and a Christian and so on. But you're here to talk about Christmas this time. Is Christmas a busy time in your household, Gillian?
Christmas is a crazy busy time for us. I'm married to a vicar and I've got two young children. So presents have been thought about but not bought. Mm-hmm. Tree is up. Mm-hmm. Nativity plays have been attended. but there's still a long way to go until we get turkey on Christmas Day.
I know what it's like. I'm married to a minister as well, and Christmas is a very busy time indeed, especially if you've got kids in the mix as well. But well done for making it. Thank you very much for being on the Christmas edition of Unbelievable today. Mark, Christmas a special time for you?
Yes, very much so, because my wife is Spanish, my daughter is Spanish, and I want my daughter to have the very best of both traditions.
Right.
And also to make up her own mind.
Yes. So, are the celebrations very different in Spain to here in the UK?
They are really quite different. Mm. There are in Spain, January the 6th is much more important.
Right.
Epiphany, the visit of the kings. Father Christmas is something that's only recently appeared.
It's a bit of an American tradition, if anything, isn't it? Yeah, the modern incarnation, at least.
Yes,
of a
little
Christmas.
Bit. But yeah. We have our nativity scene, and we love putting that up. Great. Every house in Spain has its own nativity, and some of them are very elaborate.
Right.
And it's something that we do every Christmas, is a route of nativity scenes in Madrid, or when we were back in Tenerife, and some of them are huge,
right.
And they are so beautiful, spectacular.
Now, people may be asking, how did a man from the UK end up as a more or less permanent resident in Madrid? It's because of partly the work that you do there, isn't it?
Exactly. I'm an astronomer, so where is the best place in Europe to be an astronomer? That was the Canary Islands. And after a good few years in the Canary Islands, I saw an advertisement for a job with the European Space Agency. Put in my CV just in case, and here I am.
There you are.
It is amazing.
And you've been there for a number of years.
I've been there for 12 years now.
Gazing at the night sky.
It's like Disneyland for grown-ups. It really is like Disneyland for grown-ups.
You got the job you dreamed of when you were a kid, basically.
Exactly.
Yeah. This has, of course, led you in recent years to investigate this whole story of the wise men and the star and so on. You've written an enormous amount about it. In fact, there's 10 blogs, which I will post up the link for with the show today, so that people can find out in a lot more detail than we'll probably get to about your investigations into the whole story of the star. But you don't come at this specifically as a Christian yourself. So what made you so interested in the Star of Bethlehem story?
Well, it's a wonderful story. I was always a kid interested in space and astronomy, and one of my earliest memories is of watching the news, a link up in space between two spacecraft. And when I was 7 years old, got up early one morning, Christmas Day, you know, I was nobody around, went down, opened the curtains, looked out of the window, and there was Venus, the moon quite close by. And it was just so spectacular. It was so beautiful. And that was more than 50 years ago now. And I am quite sure that that's what started me thinking. Because I've been interested in the Star of Bethlehem almost as long as I can remember.
Mm. That's interesting. Well, and we're going to get into some of the theories that abound around it, where you fall on that, and talk about the Magi as well. We'll hear as well from Gillian with your reflections on that. Gillian, I'm sure you probably haven't done quite as much research in the area as Mark has, but you have obviously done a lot of writing and thinking and speaking about generally science and faith and putting the two of them together. Do you want to just quickly describe the book that we didn't cover so much last time you were on, which is the first one you wrote, which, as I mentioned, is called Introducing Science and Religion, A Pathway. So what's that all about? A Path Through Polemic, you called it.
Sure. So it came out of my experience of being a parish priest. I previously did a PhD in physics, went off and got ordained, then worked as a parish priest. And I was really shocked at how many people thought you had to choose between science and religion of all socioeconomic backgrounds. So very clever people with lots of degrees and people who had never sort of finished school believed you had to choose. And I found that really frustrating. That's not what the history of science and religion tells us. So I wrote a book debunking this idea that science and religion are in conflict. This is fake news emerging in the 19th century. So having debunked that, I gave options for how people might want to relate their faith to science, whether they want to keep them apart. So one is for telling us how the world works. One of us is telling us why the world works. Or if you want to move them closer into dialogue, that they somehow inform one another, or if you want to sort of marry them together in an integration model. So giving people models of how they do that and how that might impact on their faith and how they think about the physical world.
Mm. Great. Well, we won't get too much time to go into great detail the book, but I know it's available and from gillianstrain.com, that's your website, and I'll make sure there's links to the openspacescience.blog website where you've posted a great deal on the Star of Bethlehem as well.
I always find this amazing, Gillian. Do people not realise the Vatican, the Jesuits have a long tradition of science? Some of the most important craters on the moon are named for Jesuit scientists and astronomers. The Vatican's got a major observatory in the United States. Yeah. People just don't realise these things.
I think that's very true. I mean, the early genetic theory was done by a monk, Mendel. Scientists have always been at the forefront of science. All the greats of the scientific revolution were Christian men. But certainly this conflict myth is very strong, and I think that's to do with how it's presented in the media. Mm. I think it's to do with how people like easy choices. And I think the church really has fallen short. It hasn't done it the best work it could to promote the idea that science religion can exist in harmony.
Mm. Yes. Well, we're going to talk about specifically the whether there is a sort of some science behind the Christmas story itself across the course of the programme today. Very much looking forward to what you both bring to this conversation. And as we do that, if you want to get in touch with the programme and leave your thoughts, then do email in. As usual, it's unbelievable@premier.org.uk. You can also leave thoughts via social media. Follow me on Twitter @unbelievablejb or facebook.com/unbelievablejb the show page, and there are links from today's website for the programme. You can comment underneath today's show and so on. That's all available from the website premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. So we're looking at the science behind Christmas on the programme today with Mark Kidger, who's a astronomer with the European Space Agency, and Gillian Strain, an Anglican priest with a background in physics research herself. And I did promise something a little bit cute as well on the programme today. So why don't we hear, to start with, a little bit of Henry, who's going to be telling us his version of the Christmas story.
Mary and Joseph couldn't find a place to sleep for the night, but they had a newborn baby, Jesus. And so Mary and Joseph were going off the bed until Jesus started crying, a newborn baby. And then a bright star appeared in the sky. The three wise men followed the star in the sky and led them to the newborn baby. And they gave three gifts to the newborn baby to stop him from crying. They gave him myrrh, frankincense and gold. And the angels told shepherds to come and visit a newborn baby, which is going to be the new king of Bethlehem. The end.
There you go. Very cute. They gave the presents to stop the baby Jesus crying. We all know that. But if you want the official version, let me just read it, the story of the wise men, from Matthew 2. It's only 8 verses long, and yet we've had so much interesting material just from these scant verses, haven't we, Mark? But let's read it out. This is how the NIV puts it. After Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea during the time of King Herod, Magi from the east came to Jerusalem and asked, "Where is the one who has been born King of the Jews? We saw his star when it rose, and we have come to worship him." When King Herod heard this, he was disturbed, and all Jerusalem with him. When he had called together all the people's chief priests and teachers of the law, he asked them where the Messiah was to be born. "In Bethlehem in Judea," they replied, "for this is what the prophet has written. But you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah, for out of you will come a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel." Then Herod called the Magi secretly and found out from them the exact time the star had appeared. He sent them to Bethlehem and said, "Go and search carefully for the child. As soon as you find him, report to me, so that I too may go and worship him." After they had heard the king, they went on their way, and the star they had seen when it rose went ahead of them until it stopped over the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they were overjoyed. On coming to the house, they saw the child with his mother Mary, and they bowed down and worshipped him. Then they opened their treasures and presented him with gifts of gold, frankincense and myrrh. And having been warned in a dream not to go back to Herod, they returned to their country by another route. well, we know it well, the story. But there's been all kinds of theories put forward about the star, including, obviously, the one that, well, there never was a star. It's just a sort of pious fiction, essentially, that Matthew invented to give a sort of regal announcement to the birth. What's led you to the view, Mark, that actually there is a scientific basis to the Star of Bethlehem?
Yeah, it's a very interesting one, because people are really split on this one. The theologians, in general, think the star didn't exist, because they say Luke, who also talks of the Nativity, doesn't mention it.
Or the wise men, I mean.
Or the wise men. The Luke's version of the Nativity is completely different to Matthew's version. There's no element in common.
There's a few elements. The Bethlehem side, at least.
Bethlehem is obviously the newborn child. But even in there, Luke's version is talking about a much older child, not a newborn baby. And then you've got the scientists who, in general, there's a feeling that there's just too much detail in Matthew's account for it to be fake news, as Gillian mentioned a little bit earlier, and that probably there is something behind it. We've also got a number of apocryphal gospels that mention the Star of Bethlehem and the Magi, and there are so many details in the Nativity story of Luke and Matthew that we can actually verify historically, that it really does make you wonder. Maybe it was a genuine account of something that did happen.
I mean, generally speaking, how invested are you, Gillian, in the sort of the historicity of the story, and particularly, I suppose, the Star of Bethlehem?
For me, you know, it's not a deal breaker. You know, we weren't there. We don't know if it happened. There may be evidence. It could have been this or that. Mark, I know, it's got all the details. It could be a comet. Could have been a supernova. Could have been something. But we weren't there. So for me, my faith doesn't hang on whether or not that star was real. My faith hangs on who Jesus Christ was and what he did in his life, particularly around the resurrection. So for me, the star and the Magi are interesting and important, because I think they link us back into the Old Testament, the Hebrew Bible prophecy around who was to come. They're interesting and important because they reveal something about how the gospel writers wanted to make an impact on those around them, the Romans and the Greeks. That's important and interesting. But for me, they're not deal breakers.
Okay. It's interesting to hear that. In a sense, you obviously see that there's some really interesting ways, though, in which the story as related in Matthew connects with what we do know, because in a sense we can astronomically turn the clock back 2,000 years, can't we, Mark?
And yes, very much.
What
we can.
The sky looked like, you know, in around that time.
But we also know that almost all of the personalities who are mentioned by Luke and by Matthew existed. We know Herod was king. We've got a good idea when Herod died. We've got historical details of the death of Herod. We know about Quirinius. We know that he was governor or governor's legate in Syria about this time. We know he organized a census. We know that Caesar Augustus organized three censuses during his reign, because he knew that he had to understand the empire to be able to rule the empire efficiently. And there are so many historical details. We even know where Herod's tomb is. There is still a place in close to Bethlehem, outside Bethlehem, called Shepherd's Field, and you can find the caves where the shepherds kept their flocks at night in winter. There are so many details that we can verify.
I've sometimes heard sceptics cast out on the story of the slaughter of the innocents by Herod, though, and others come back and say, well, if you look at Herod's sort of record when it came to the way he treated both his family and his enemies, it doesn't in any way surprise the idea that he could order such a good record.
You've got to remember, at the time of the Nativity, Herod was dying. He was suffering from an extremely unpleasant disease. Literally, his body was rotting. The descriptions that we've got from historians allow doctors to work out what symptoms, what illness Herod had. The poor man, he was paranoid. He was treading a very delicate course between Rome and the Jewish people. He had a good idea what was going to happen to his kingdom on his death. And he wasn't overly enthusiastic about the idea of having a king who might upset the boat.
So for you, this visit of the wise men to Herod in Jerusalem and so on is a plausible one as far as you can see.
It's a very plausible one because we, for one very, very interesting, important detail, we know it wasn't the only visit of the Magi because three Roman historians, including Pliny, write about the visit of the Magi to Nero in 68 AD. King Tiridates, who is described as a magus, brought a large group with him, some accounts say as many as 5,000 people,
right.
And the many Magi. Nero was interested in Magi because he had killed his mother, and he went to Magi to see if there was any way that he could bring back her spirit and atone for the murder. And so we've got a lot of details of that visit of the Magi to Rome.
We'll come in a minute to the different theories around the star, but let's, as we're talking about the Magi, talk about them, because there are also theories about who they were. What's your favoured view as to who these mysterious visitors were?
Yes, well, the favoured theory for many years was that they were Babylonians, because we know that Babylon had a large Jewish colony, a diaspora. Mm. And they knew a lot about Jewish traditions. They had a lot of contact with the Roman world. But that's not where Magi came from. Magi were Zoroastrian priests from northern Persia, what we now call Iran. And we know exactly where they came from. Tiridates was an Armenian. He came from there. That area, they still practice Zoroastrianism. They've got traditions that are very similar to the Christian tradition of the virgin birth, a saviour, the Messiah. And although we don't know very much about the Persians, that does seem to be a very, very plausible idea if you've got Magi. And then there's that interesting little detail that back in the 13th century, when Marco Polo went to Cathay, he visited a small village in the north of Persia called Savay. And there, the people said, oh, you're a Christian. The Magi came from our town when they visited Jesus. Now, why would they tell Marco Polo that?
Why would they have that tradition? Yes.
If it didn't have some basis of truth.
That's interesting. Theologically speaking, Gillian, why do you think Matthew wants to tell the story of the Magi? Because in a way, it's somewhat strange to include a completely what appears to be non-Jewish, if you like, visitation at the very beginning of his gospel.
I think Matthew... Matthew got frustrated with the mission of the church post the resurrection within the Jewish society. So he was very keen to reach out into the Hellenistic, the Greek communities. So showing that Jesus was revered as a baby from people outside the Jewish faith as a leader would have been important for his mission. And so writing in a birth narrative would have been very important for him to make his point. And also linking back into the Old Testament prophets about gift-giving to show that also he had the Jewish roots as well.
Yeah. I mean, now, obviously, in our nativity stories, it's always three wise men. We obviously don't get a number in Matthew's gospel, but we do get three gifts, and I think that's where the association comes from.
Of course, yes.
Any ideas on numbers, or is it not important as far as you're concerned,
Mark? I don't think it's important. The only thing we know is that in the original Greek, and I think, Gillian, you will agree with me that the original Greek is not very original. It dates from about the 14th century. They use the word magoi, plural, instead of magus. So we know there was more than one.
Okay.
But that's about all. And the names of the three wise men They only became kings in the 6th century.
Yes,
as Gillian would say, it was all about street cred. They wanted to give street credibility, and so the wise men, the magi, became kings in the 6th century. Their names only started to appear about the 8th century, Balthasar, Gaspar and Melchior.
And this owes presumably a lot to tradition and people sort of accumulating sort of particular ways of thinking about visitors over the centuries.
It's a lovely story behind them. It's one, Gillian, I'm sure you'll be able to elaborate much more on this, but the very earliest representations of the Magi with their names, you can see Balthasar is clearly an African. The tradition is he was from Egypt. Gaspar is a European. Melchior is Asiatic. And you can actually see in the Ravella mosaic that the different skin colour even. And what was that a message of? It was the three known peoples of the earth, the Asian, yellow Asians, the black Africans, the white Europeans, and a sign that Jesus represented all the peoples of the earth.
Well, I mean, I like the line in that carol which says, seek in him the great desire of nations, and this idea that Matthew at some level, Gillian, I don't know if you would agree, is trying to show to his readers that Jesus somehow fulfills all religious searching. So he brings in these visitors from a far off place to say this is not just for the Jewish people, this is for all people in that sense.
Yes, absolutely. And in the way they're trying to propagate the gospel, and of course these are it's great to hear the historical truth about or historical views or historical interpretations of what they might be, and of course you know there's going to be a truth within the gospel and so on, but I think the idea that myth is somehow a negative thing is quite, I get quite annoyed by that, I guess, because myths are how we come up with who we are as people. So you have historical facts, you know, and we could argue about that until the cows come home. But what they mean to people is much more important within the faith structure.
Interesting stuff. We're going to go to a break, and then we're going to get into the stars themselves and look at the night sky as it would have appeared back then, and work out where you stand, Mark, on what this phenomenon may or may not have been. Do keep listening, and if you want to get in touch again, you can email in unbelievable@premier.org.uk. We're looking at the science behind Christmas on the programme today. My guests are Mark Kidger and Gillian Strain.
Welcome to the programme that brings Christians and non-Christians together with me, Justin Brierley.
For over 10 years, as host of Unbelievable, I've listened to objections to faith from the world's leading sceptics. And the most common question I get is, how come you still believe? Unbelievable, the book, is my answer. Telling the story of the show and drawing on hundreds of conversations with atheists and Christians, I explain why I still believe Jesus is the answer to life's deepest questions. Get your copy of Unbelievable, Why After 10 Years of Talking with Atheists, I'm Still a Christian, at unbelievablebook.co.uk.
Welcome back to our special Christmas edition of Unbelievable. Looking at the science behind Christmas today, Mark Kidger is from the European Space Agency. He's done a lot of writing on the Star of Bethlehem, and we're going to be looking at some of his the different views of what that might or might not have been from different perspectives. Gillian Strain, Anglican priest with a background in physics research, who's written a book, Introducing Science and Religion, A Path Through Polemic. And we're talking about some of the miraculous elements of the Christmas story today, and especially the Star of Bethlehem is what we've been concentrating on. And playing a few versions of what children make of the story, retold by some of the youngsters who have been interviewed for Premier Christian Radio. And let's start with 6-year-old Alba telling again the story of the wise men.
So the three wise men were also out of Jerusalem, and they travelled and travelled and travelled very far with their three presents. And there's a song to go with that: gold, myrrh and frankincense. And then they give them their presents and they are really happy and they all go away and their birth is perfect. But the king was very angry because his plan did not work. So they never, ever, ever was friends with the king and the happily ever after in their house.
Alba retelling a little bit of the story of the wise men. Now we've heard that you actually you think there's a lot in the historical details actually of the story, however Alba relates it, Mark, that gives you cause to think there really is something behind this, just from a sort of historical and scientific perspective. We talked a little bit about the history of the Magi, but what about the star itself? Now this is where things get really interesting, because there have been so many theories put forward over the centuries, haven't there, about this, for those who do think there's a sort of scientific basis to it. I'll just rattle off a few of them. Could it have been Venus, an atmospheric phenomenon, a meteor or meteors, Uranus, Halley's Comet, a near-Earth asteroid, a supernova, a planetary conjunction, even a UFO? They've all been put forward. Do you want to kind of pick up on any of those and sort of say what you think of them and what has been popular and what you think has been can be dismissed fairly easily?
Well, Venus is a very popular one. Now, for example, Christmas Day, you look out of the window as I did when I was 7 years old, and you'll see Venus shining very, very brilliant in the morning sky. Every time that happens, people ask me, was that the Star of Bethlehem? Is that the Star of Bethlehem? As many people do actually wonder if Venus is the Star of Bethlehem, because they don't recognise the planets any longer. Now, obviously, if the wise men were really wise, they'd have known what Venus was. It's visible most years at Christmas. But if you believe everything that Matthew says about how the star appears, disappears, reappears, moves from the east to the south, then there isn't a logical explanation. It does so many different mysterious things that's where some people come from with the idea it's a UFO. There are so few details and they're so vague, it's very easy to come up with a different theory. Many of the theories are crazy, but I mean, me, they're crazy.
Well yes.
Gillian's laughing.
The one that we discussed 2 years ago when you were on the programme, I interviewed Colin Nichols, who at the time had authored this book, The Great Christ Comet.
Yes.
And so he came down on the view that it was a comet, essentially. Now, that's not the view you take, is it?
No, exactly, because comets all through history, right up until recent times, even 100 years ago, were regarded as harbingers of disaster.
Right.
Nobody had a good word to say about comets. And there are stories even from very recent times that in 1973, during the Arab-Israeli war, a bright comet appeared in the dawn sky. And some of the Arab soldiers genuinely believed it was an Israeli secret weapon.
Right.
it seems incredible now, but we can, though, turn the clock back and you can say, okay, if the star really existed, what might it have been, just looking at the sky as we know it from 2,000 years ago? So that's the viewpoint that I set out from, that, you know, if it did exist, because if it didn't exist, it's going to be a very short book anyway. What could it have been plausibly?
And another popular view I've heard, and I'll see what Gillian makes of any of these in a moment, but is planetary conjunction. And
yes.
I think Rick Larson made a kind of documentary that got a lot of people thinking, oh, this must be the answer. And you can explain exactly what the hypothesis was and why you don't actually think that works historically in the time frame.
Yeah, that's a good one, because the Magi were almost certainly astrologers more than astronomers. That one of the functions of Magi, apart from being priests, was to cast horoscopes. And that was the function of court astronomers through history until certainly the 17th century. And planetary conjunctions, when two planets come close together in the sky, would have been very, very important for them. And we know that in 7 BC there was a particular conjunction. Jupiter, the king of planets, Saturn, the bringer of change, came together three times in the sky in the constellation of Pisces. And Pisces, as we all know, it's the fishes. What was the symbol of Jesus? How did Christians recognize each other?
Yeah.
Fish.
Yeah.
And it was something that Johannes Kepler pointed out in the start of the 17th century, that this conjunction had appeared. And it's about the time of the Nativity, and for an astrologer, it would have been incredibly significant.
Mm.
But it wouldn't have been very spectacular. It would have been, it's not something that the average person would have noticed. Even somebody who knew the stars very well,
right,
they wouldn't have noticed.
So it doesn't
it very
seem
much.
Quite significant enough as an event in the night sky to warrant this sort of reaction.
It's not the sort of great event that you would expect Matthew to be writing about 80 years later.
The person I mentioned, Rick Larson, I think he made his view was that it was something like Regulus and Jupiter.
Okay, yes, that's a later one. That was at there was one in 3 BC and one in 2 BC with Venus, Jupiter, Regulus in the constellation of the Lion. Again, Lion, the Lion of Judah. Very strong astrological connotations. But as far as we can tell, Herod died sometime in late March or early April of 4 BC. We've got some quite good historical evidence that says that. He didn't have a time machine, as far as we're aware.
So if these events were within the lifetime of Herod, then that rules out that slightly later appearance.
Exactly.
I think the way, unless we're
horribly wrong
I'm going into the detail of this now, but I think that the way that Rick Larson squared that was by redating Herod's death, but I don't think that's generally accepted by most people.
So there are a lot of other reasons for thinking that the Nativity was 5, 6, 7 BC, that we know the details of how old Jesus was when he died. We know when Pontius Pilate went to Jerusalem. And you can fit together, you can shift the dates around, and you get a little window.
Interesting.
About 2 or 3 years when all the persons named in the story and all the dates that we know about just fit together. And that's 5, 6, 7 BC.
Well, before we get to your preferred explanation, Gillian, what's your take on all of the sort of weaving together of the history and the science and the so on? To what extent do you find this a helpful or not exercise in establishing these things?
Well, I'm listening to Mark, and it's wonderful, isn't it? All this details and the science, and the way you can do is it archaeological astronomy and wind the clock back and have a look. And I think it's fascinating and amazing what human beings can do. And that drive to understand, that drive to find an explanation, I think that's very much part of who we are as human beings. But, you know, I don't go to the Bible to learn about the stars. If I wanted to learn about the stars and astronomy, I'd go to the European Space Agency or Google some astronomy. At the time the Bible was written, they had an Aristotelian view of the universe. They understood the Earth was at the centre, right? And that the stars were fixed on crystalline spheres which rotated around. They had very complicated mathematics to make it all work. So their idea of astronomy was very different to what we understand now. Mm. The Bible is not an astronomy textbook. It's something very different. So my view on the star was it might have been one of these theories might be true.
Mm-hmm.
And that wouldn't surprise me in the least because I believe God created the universe. So for God, that wouldn't be that hard.
Mm.
I feel it's more likely to be a miraculous event, if anything. And we can discuss what miracles are. But it really doesn't. I guess that drive to find explanations is one thing. What they mean is another, and that's much more the concern of.
I did a show earlier in the year in which I sat down with Cambridge scientist. The name's gone out of my head at this moment, but he's written a book about looking at various natural events and how he believes that they are. That's what the Bible stories are based on, and that things that purportedly might be miraculous, like the parting of the Red Sea, actually there is such a thing as wind set down, and this could be an explanation for this particular event happening, and we know that it has happened and so on. I mean, are you worried about sort of trying to find, in that sense, natural explanations for divine phenomena in the Bible?
I'm not worried about it. I just don't think it's that interesting and that important for people of faith. Because we believe God made the universe. You know, why on earth couldn't God intervene and create miracles like the plagues of Egypt? Or a star appearing that might lead a wise man to a house. And how would that happen if it was a star anyway? I think it's much more interesting to think about why some people are driven to want to find explanations of the Bible, whereas other people would derive their faith from an experience of love.
It's interesting because I do hear two very different ways of approaching, you know, this whole area between the two of you. And in some ways, whereas you might think, oh, the Christian's more likely to sort of be trying to establish the historical factuality of it, I think you're less concerned with that, Julian, whereas that really interests you, Mark, interestingly.
It does. It does very much, because I like to understand the historical scientific truth behind events. And I've actually found that when I give a talk about the Star of Bethlehem, many Christians sit there and listen. Isn't that fantastic? I think how wonderful it is we can actually demonstrate these events really did happen.
And I think, of course, well, I think it's great to get some backup, some evidence for our faith. But Mark, you're an astronomer. I once spent some time on an observatory in France and had the opportunity to see a very distant galaxy through a telescope, which was great from a scientific point of view. And we could think about how telescopes worked. And that was interesting from a how does this work point of view. But when I looked through that telescope and saw the distant galaxy, what actually happened in that moment was a photon, which had been travelling, years, entered into my body and caused an electrical signal at the back of my eye, and I had an image of it. So this was me becoming part of this universe, and I was taken into a place thinking about scale and time and creation, and I had a very deep reaction to that experience of science that changed how I thought about the universe. So this isn't not just sort of stuff and information. These impact on how people understand their place within God's creation. And that's what I get excited about.
Right, yeah.
Well, that galaxy that you were seeing it as it existed tens of millions, probably hundreds of millions of years ago. I can't even prove that galaxy still exists. It's a matter of faith that
galaxy
still exists.
That is the remarkable thing, isn't it? Talk about having gone through in some detail in both your book and the blogs you've written more recently on the Star of Bethlehem, you do come to a preferred explanation. Do you want to tell us what your view is of what this star could have been?
Yes, I do. I find the conjunction in 7 BC very interesting. Because that's the sort of thing that if you're an astrologer, you would look at it and you'd think, something is going to happen. But I don't think it was on its own sufficient. That we know that in March 5 BC, Chinese astronomers and also Korean astronomers observed something very bright in the eastern sky. It appears to have been in the constellation of Capricorn, north of Capricorn, the south of Aquila, the eagle. It was bright enough that they could see it in the dawn sky for 70 days. And then the monsoon season started. So they'd have had many cloudy nights. They wouldn't have... they didn't say it disappeared. They just say that it was visible for more than 70 days. And probably it was just the monsoon that stopped them following it more. We've got a quite precise position for it to within a reasonably small area on the sky. And it looks to me as if probably that was a bright nova, not a supernova. We know that there wasn't a supernova in this area of the sky, but a nova, which is a pair of old stars that one of the stars is cannibal. It's feeding off the other star. There's a massive explosion on the surface of the smaller star. It blows off a huge mass of material, and for a few days, weeks, maybe months, becomes
much more visible,
millions of times brighter.
Right. And this we're talking about something that's probably millions of light years away, but nonetheless from Earth, just for a period of time, it becomes bright and visible.
Probably
to this nova event.
Hundreds of light years away, yes. And if I wanted to be provocative, I wouldn't be provocative with Gillian, I might say that it was a miraculous event that this star appeared at just the right time.
The timing
very
in that sense
one.
Was miraculous,
exactly.
You would say. I mean, scientifically, novas happen, I guess, all the time in the universe, but...
But very bright ones are not so common.
Okay.
And this is something that I find a lot of Christians find interesting.
Yes, and this is based off
the right time.
These Chinese records,
yes.
And they were quite good at keeping records.
They were very good, and a lot of the Chinese records, we can go to telescopes, radio telescopes, and we can find the objects they saw, and we can confirm them. They've got really detailed observations of Halley's Comet. They describe the tail. They even describe the colour of the comet, the motion of the comet in the sky, something that they didn't do with this object.
What would have... But I think one bit of the story that people struggle with is but how would a star specifically lead them to the dwelling place, if you like? That seems like, okay, one thing to say, there's a star, let's go travelling, another to kind of pitch up at the house of Jesus.
Right, exactly. Well, actually, there's a very, very simple explanation for it, that every day stars rise 4 minutes earlier. It's because... the rotation of the Earth's rotation around the sun, that the stars just change positions very slowly day by day.
So as night draws on, the star appears a little later on each time.
Exactly.
It
was in the dawn sky in March. Mm-hmm. If you imagine the Magi came from Persia, that's about 2,000 kilometres by the best road. That's 6 weeks, 2 months journey maybe on camels. By that time, where would have the star been in the dawn sky? It would have been due south. If you go to Jerusalem, which direction do you have to head to get to Bethlehem?
Due south.
Mm-hmm. It just hangs together.
Okay,
it
all hangs together quite nicely. That's really interesting. What's your take on all this, Gillian?
I'm smiling. It's great that it's a clear explanatory structure. And I was really fascinated, eyebrows raised, to hear Mark talk about the miraculous as a scientist, as an agnostic scientist, why that might have been interpreted as miraculous from his point of view. It's no surprise to me as a Christian that miracles are part of this story.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, stars formed with the birth of many great leaders, of Roman leaders, Greek philosophers often associated with stars appearing. So this is quite obviously, if you're writing a gospel, want to convince people, give him a star. But more than that, I think the life of Jesus Christ, there were miracles throughout, the healing miracles, and of course, the miracle of the resurrection. So a miraculous appearance of a star for me is much more of a symbolic thing about what Jesus might have been, and I believe through faith it was a miraculous occurrence.
Are you happy with the idea that it could have had this as it were natural explanation as well, in that sense?
God created the universe. God is there's lots of different ways that you can interpret how God might interact with the physical order. My particular point is the universe is contained within God's being, so it is no surprise. It has a satisfying feeling with me when I hear these kind of explanations, but no surprise, no great revelation.
It's consistent in that. I think you did a straw poll on Twitter before you came on air to work out what generally your followers made of the story of the star. What came back?
So I'm not sure how many people, being still a bit of a scientist, I'm not sure on the statistical significance of my poll, but 63% of people who answered believed it was real. And it happened. The rest thought it either was an insertion in the story or that it doesn't matter. It's
not
important.
That's interesting. And this is primarily Christians feeding back. You asked for Christians to feed. Okay, so that was the sample pool.
Yeah.
and 63% felt that it was relaying a real event,
yes.
And others felt it was a sort of...
But of course, that depends how you define real.
Indeed.
Doesn't it? And
yes.
I went to my kids' nativity play yesterday, and that was lovely. We had a little boy dressed up as the star. They made I came, one fell over a pram, the star needed a wee in the middle of the show, so, and then when he came back he couldn't find Mary and Joseph again, and that was the children. And the head teacher at the end said, you know, look, this story is about love coming into our world, and our world needs that. And that's real. That's a real interpretation of the story.
Right. I mean, there are obviously other miraculous elements of this story. There's angelic visitations, there's, you know, the Virgin Mary bearing a child. different Christians I know take different views on just how essential that doctrine is, as it were, for faith. What's your view on the story of the virgin birth specifically, Gillian?
So there's different textual interpretations about what virgin meant. It might have meant the traditional meaning we would have today of a woman not having intercourse, but it could have been that a woman hadn't reached maturity yet and not had her first menstruation. So there's different interpretations of what a virgin might have been. So my interpretation as a Christian is that that was a miraculous occurrence that signified that Christ was a special, the birth was somehow special and becoming God incarnate. I have a problem. I feel that the virginity of Mary, the perpetual virginity, that she always remained a virgin, has textual difficulties, as in some...
Now, that's more of a Catholic doctrine.
Yes, it's more of a Catholic doctrine, but I mean, there's issues around the body and the treatment of women within the church that have derived from that aspect, so it's been overemphasized.
Right.
So it's complex, but again, I wasn't there, and through faith... that was a special birth that has theological significance, both negative and positive.
What would your non-Christian scientific colleagues have said, though, when you were in the physics laboratory, the idea that you do believe in that a human child could come in that kind of situation? Wouldn't most people be rather sceptical and say, as a scientist, how can you believe in that?
Yeah. I think for me, the virgin... birth, the conception of Jesus, isn't one of those deal breakers. Mm-hmm. So I've chosen through faith to think that God was a part of that. I think for me, my work as a scientist was to study the physical universe. And if we met a problem that we couldn't solve, I wouldn't insert God into that. So we don't understand what happens at matter at the subatomic level. I don't think that's an entry point for God. We don't understand what started the Big Bang. For me as a scientist, I wouldn't say, well, it must be God. I don't think God is a thing to slot into equations when we don't know. Science is a constant process of theories, our best theories about how the universe works. So as a scientist, I'd never introduce the miraculous into any kind of discourse.
I noticed this tweet by Glenn Scrivener on Twitter, which I'd just be interested in both your responses to. He said this, Christians believe in the virgin birth of Jesus. Materialists believe in the virgin birth of the cosmos. Choose your miracle. What's your response to that, Julia? I'll see what Mark has to say.
So the virgin birth of the cosmos.
I mean, I suppose the point is, we all... ultimately have faith in something. Maybe the materialist who says there is no God still believes this all came from somewhere and doesn't have an explanation, believes in that sense in quote-unquote virgin birth of the cosmos. Well, is it that much of a stretch if you're to believe that a child could be born by virgin conception? We've all got our miracles, I suppose, is Glenn's point there.
Quite, and I think with modern science, I think scientists are increasingly having to be more comfortable with uncertainty. If we look at the very boundaries of science, particularly around Big Bang theory, I mean, physics can only go back so far. We can't, because of the laws of physics, go right back to that moment of what we would call creation. There's always going to be unknown within science. And they can have theories about why it might have gone one way or the other. But dealing in uncertainty, I think, is a place where science and religion can have real conversations because there's genuine overlap.
Mark, a lot of stuff to possibly talk about there, but just briefly before we get to the end of this section, what did you make of that phrase? Christians believe in the virgin birth of Jesus, materialists believe in the virgin birth of the cosmos, choose your
miracle.
I'm
smiling about it because I'm about to be provocative again.
Okay, go on.
Many... of the miracles are things that these days are such an everyday occurrence. You're talking about virgin birth. It's something that is so much a part of our everyday lives now that we don't even realize it.
IVF, are you talking about that?
In vitro fertilization.
Okay.
What is that other than virgin birth? Turning water into wine. Have you ever taken a packet of dried orange juice, put it into a glass of water? If you don't know what's happening, that's a miracle. It's not wine, but it's orange juice, but you know what I mean. Curing the leper, good strong dose of penicillin. It appears, even to people 40, 50 years ago, it appeared miraculous that you could give somebody a good strong dose of antibiotic and you could cure a terrible illness like that. They're miracles that are part of our everyday lives. Now, it's something that miracle often depends on the context. Now, I'm not sure how to put this. If Jesus had powers that were in advance of his time, there are many miracles that he could have done that would have seemed absolutely incredible to people 2,000 years ago, but to us would be quite normal. You can walk on water. I'm sure you've done it at some time. It's called water skiing.
Right. Yes, I have actually had a go at
things,
that.
Things like that. I know I'm being provocative.
No, I appreciate that. It's done with a slight, tug-in-cheek way. But we'll come back to you, Gillian, for a response on that in a moment. We've just reached the end of our second part of today's programme, and we'll start to wrap the programme up. We're looking at the science behind Christmas. Lots of interesting directions we can go in the last few minutes of the show today. My guests are Gillian Strain and Mark Kidger.
Join me, Justin Brierley, as the big conversation continues with Daniel Dennett and Keith Ward.
Purposes emerge from the bottom up, from a purposeless process. That's the genius of Darwin's idea.
Well, I think that's a heroic project.
It is.
I don't think it's a possible one.
Michael Roos and John Lennox.
I think the physical resurrection is totally unimportant.
The problem of physical death has actually been solved historically. I want to know about it. To say it's irrelevant, I just don't understand, especially from a philosopher.
Join the conversation on life's biggest questions at thebigconversation.show.
Welcome back to the final part of this week's festive edition of Unbelievable, and we'll return to the final part of the conversation between Gillian and Mark in just a moment. If you can keep listening this afternoon to Unbelievable towards the end of today's show, another special guest joining me, N.T. Wright, or Tom Wright as he's often known, who I've been hosting a new podcast with, the Ask N.T. Wright Anything podcast. That's been really well received. I'll read out actually some of the feedback we've had to that podcast. On a recent edition of the programme, I asked him whether we can trust the historicity of the Christmas stories in Matthew and Luke. And you'll hear his response to that towards the end of today's programme. A quick heads up on what's happening on next week's Unbelievable show. I'll be hosting a conversation on the unlikely friendship that took place between international evangelist Kevin Pillau, son of Lewis Pillau, and Portland's secular gay mayor, Sam Adams. What they did in Portland to make a difference despite their differences. It's all in a book called Unlikely, written by Kevin Pillau, and it's a really interesting conversation on the effect that both parties had on each other as they grew to be friends and to understand and learn from each other in the process. That's next week on Unbelievable. Straight after the show today, however, if you can listen to the profile between 4 and 5, well worth hearing Tim Alford speaking to Emily Howarth of Premier Youth and Children's Work magazine. Tim heads up Limitless, the youth wing of Elim Church in the UK and Ireland, and also the former lead singer of the Christian band Dweeb as well. So you'll be hearing about their extraordinary ministry and all the plans they've got and things they're doing with young people in the UK. It's exciting stuff. And the profile is, of course, available via its own podcast as well. We'll also be hearing some of your feedback towards the end of today's show.
So first the angel came to Mary, and the name of the angel was Angel Gabriel, and this was his message from God. He said, "Greetings, do not be afraid, the Lord is with you, and decided to bless you wonderfully. Soon you have a baby boy, and you shall call him Jesus." And Mary says, "How can this be? I do not understand." And Angel Gabriel says, "Do not be afraid. The Holy Spirit will make all of this to happen." And then she gets engaged to a man called Joseph, and he had lots of other brothers. So that means Jesus had a lot of uncles and aunties.
From the mouths of babes, as they say, that was Alba filling us in on some of the details we didn't know about the Christmas story. Apparently, lots of our aunties and uncles in Jesus's life. It's been fun talking through the science behind the Christmas story. And at a serious point, the story of the virgin birth, which we've obviously been talking about in the last section of the show, does bring us to that question of, do we simply say we accept this on faith? It's a sort of revelation thing as a Christian, or do we seek in some way, you know, scientific answers to these questions? I mean, when it comes to what you present very often with the Star of Bethlehem, I think you were saying just in the break there, Mark, that it seems to engage both believers and non-believers, this idea that there could be a scientific explanation for where the Star of Bethlehem came from.
Yes, exactly. And very few people are ever offended, because if you're a believer, the fact that I can say, look at this part of the sky, that's where the star appeared, they think that is absolutely wonderful. That reaffirms their belief. And if they're a non-believer, they feel very satisfied that there is a nice, simple explanation and they don't have to worry about the gospel.
My thought might be that, but if you can show that there's some scientific basis in such an event, that might give them cause to reconsider whether actually there might be something in this story, because I thought it was just fairy tales and nonsense before, whereas, maybe actually that it was based on some historical actual, you know, events and so on. So I don't know. I mean, does it necessarily cause the skeptic to discount it by having provided a natural explanation for a phenomenon?
I don't know. I'm very, very careful always to give all the historical basis that I can of the evidence and say, very respectfully, look, these parts of the Bible story we can prove.
Mm.
No, it's not just a bunch of stories.
Yeah. I mean, you're wary yourself, obviously, of using the Bible for scientific purposes in that sense, Julian, aren't you? And I don't know what you made as well about Mark's earlier comments about, well, there's a lot of things that were considered miraculous, which which we see today. Virgin birth effectively can be produced scientifically by IVF and so on. What's your thoughts on all of that?
Well, they're not miracles then. I think but the definition of miracle is something that cannot be explained by science, is some kind of direct intervention by the divine to change the physical order. So in the Bible, there's many miracles, and they're there because we can't prove them one way or the other because we weren't there. But they're there to show us, for example, the healing miracles, to show us the power of Christ over the universe. It was also showing us something about sin and sickness, whether or not they're linked. So they show us something about who Jesus is in the miracles. But once you can offer an explanation, they no longer become miracles because science has progressed. But I'm interested in the itch, or the itch this is scratching when Mark and other people can provide explanations. And I think it's personality driven. So many Christians are satisfied by the anthropic explanation of the universe, this idea that somehow the universe after the Big Bang was set to run so that we would appear. And there's some great science behind it. If the Big Bang was just very, 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 very slightly different, then carbon life wouldn't have emerged.
Yeah.
It would have changed the planets and so on.
The fine tuning of the universe.
The fine tuning argument.
Life, yeah.
And, you know, for some Christians, that really does it. Because they make a postulation about who did the tuning.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the God is there meddling with these bits. And that genuinely satisfies many Christians as an explanation of why we're here. And that's great. But, you know, it doesn't do it for me.
Okay.
Because I worry, what if we find more science within dark matter theory? Or can we ever get quantum mechanics to merge with general relativity? You know, there's lots of unanswered out there. And if you've pinned your faith on the fact of fine-tuning and, well, that shows God's really in charge, then your faith crumbles. But also you're doing science really badly as well. I mean, science should always be open to evolve. So I think we have to take seriously that we're individuals and different things will wire in our faith differently. And, of course, God made us all unique and different, and we're all loved by him. So that it's no surprise that we will come to faith and come to a satisfactory explanation of miracles and the world.
So if you think there are better and worse ways of using science to sort of undergird faith in that sense, what would you see as the way a Christian should approach the relationship? You know, if we're not saying God's, you know, we can insert God into such and such gap, and that's a nice explanation and makes me believe God exists. Where are you coming from when it comes to the way you see science and God engaging each other in that sense? Should we ever use God as the explanation in that sense for any kind of scientific phenomena?
So I balance different hats on my head when it comes to this explanation. And I have my own answer, and a lot of people have different answers and different ways of coming to it. For me, I keep science, a scientific way of understanding the world, rather separate from the way I understand the world as a person of faith. So I believe science is a gift from God. It's the best way we know to understand the physical universe around us. But it reveals something to us of God, God the mathematician, God that's in charge. As I said before, I think the universe is held within the being of God. Mm. So there's nothing that can separate us from God through explanations of science. But with my other hat on, my hat of faith, I look at the world as uncovered by science, the theories of evolution, the theories of uncertainty we have around quantum mechanics, and use them to derive what I think is the meaning of the meaning of the world as revealed by God.
Because in a sense, you don't believe science can ultimately deliver us that kind of explanation, the meaning explanation.
No, science can never do that. And if it tries to tell you what it means, it's crossing a very important boundary. Mm. The purpose of philosophy and religion and of faith and of all of us, I think we all have power to interpret the world. So putting them all together, that's how you derive the meaning. And that's held within our scriptures, held within our church traditions, held within our experience of worship, and particularly around the story of Christmas as well, the coming of God, God incarnate, God with us, as an explanation of our lives here, of good and bad, of suffering and difficult times.
I'd be interested to know, as we draw this to a close, Mark, I've had you on a few times over the years now to talk about the Star of Bethlehem, always introducing you as an agnostic. Does any of this stuff, has it ever drawn you any closer to thinking, well, actually, maybe it's true. Maybe the birth of Jesus was something unique in history. Maybe this person was different to any other person who ever lived.
Oh, that's a difficult one.
I'm the one being provocative now, Mark.
Ask me an easy question, yes. I don't know. I go back to what I said earlier, that these days, some of the things that Jesus did would not be miracles. Mm, mm. But how would a person 2,000 years ago have had the knowledge to do those things? Now, there's one beautiful story. You know that during the Second World War, Winston Churchill became critically ill. He was given a new experimental drug called penicillin. And there was so little penicillin in the world that if Churchill and Roosevelt had both become critically ill at the same time, the world would have had to have chosen which of its two leaders to save.
I didn't know that, but yeah.
No, that's an amazing story. It's something that I started thinking about last night when I was having a conversation with my host, who is in the strange position of being an atheist who has a brother who's a priest in New Zealand.
Right.
And we started talking, and I just threw up the idea. And it really is, it's got me thinking a little bit about this. And another thing that I thought when Gillian was talking then was, Gillian, did you know at least one of the Apollo astronauts, don't hold me to this because I need to check up, I think it was Jim Irwin from Apollo 15, became an ordained priest because he found God on the moon.
Well, he obviously had... Are you saying this was such an extraordinary experience?
It's such an extraordinary experience. He found that God on the moon. Right. And he wasn't the only one of the Apollo astronauts that happened to. Some went in the other direction. There are a couple who had very serious problems with mental illness, with alcoholism. Others found God on the moon. Mm. And it's definitely, science and religion do go hand in hand. Very much so. It's very interesting. So I haven't really answered your question, but
you've artfully dodged it. Yes,
the conversation last night really did start me thinking a bit.
All right. Well, look, if there are any updates, maybe we'll find out next Christmas or something, Mark. But look, very interesting. Thank you so much for both being willing to come in and talk from your different perspectives as scientists and people interested in engaging these issues of faith. It's been a really interesting conversation today. If you want to find out more about Gillian and her books, Gillian Strain, that's with an E, .com, it's the place to go. And Mark Kidger, I'll make sure there are links to the various blogs he's written on the Star of Bethlehem as well from the show page today. So do go and check that out at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable and today's show on the science behind Christmas. But for the moment, I do wish you both, Mark and Gillian, a very happy Christmas.
Very Merry Christmas to you.
Merry Christmas, Justin.
Get in touch with the show. You can email me, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. You can also tweet at UnbelievableJB to find me on Twitter, or facebook.com/UnbelievableJB for the Facebook page. And all of those links and more available from today's show at the website, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. And I'll post alongside that some other shows that we've done in this vein, looking at the Star of Bethlehem and issues around Christmas. Mark Kidger, not the first time he's been on the show, talking about and debating those issues with others. Colin Nichols, 2 years ago, came on to talk about his theory about the Star of Bethlehem, as spelled out in his book, The Great Christ Comet. Before we hear from Tom Wright about Christmas, here's Angela, who gets in touch to say, greetings from the US. First of all, Justin, let me thank and congratulate you on your programme. I've heard you read the emails of listeners who commend you for your talent and gift as a debate moderator, and I agree with them wholeheartedly. Thanks for running a one-of-a-kind show. Thank you very much, Angela. You say, I can refer my Christian and non-Christian friends alike to this show, and I have learned so much from it as well. My faith's been both challenged and reinforced, but as a result, I've grown as a believer. Thanks for feeding my hungry and inquisitive brain. But I'd love to see more debates available on the topic of egalitarianism versus complementarianism. This topic has rocked my world as of late, but when I searched the Unbelievable episode list for discussions, I didn't come up with much. Would Unbelievable consider addressing this topic? I've learned that people are cautious and afraid to listen to egalitarian viewpoints because they wrongfully believe it would require a rewrite of biblical texts and omission of scripture to allow for gender equality. I've also found that Christian egalitarians are also mistakenly classified as being feminists seeking female domination over men, supporting homosexuality and transgender alterations, and supporters of many other non-scriptural movements. I'd love for these misconceptions to be eliminated through an educational discussion on egalitarianism, and I think Unbelievable will be a great stage for the discussion. Thanks for considering my request. Well, Angela, funnily, you should mention that, because our first show of the new year will be an egalitarian and complementarian debate. Now, if those words don't mean anything to you, very briefly, it's simply the question of how men and women should relate to each other when it comes to church and family and the doctrines that different Christians hold in regard to that as to what scripture mandates. And so we'll be doing that with Natalie Collins and Phil Moore in our opening show of 2019. It'll be on video as well, so look out for that. Before we hear more of your feedback, I just want to play out a little bit of the most recent episode of the Ask NT Wright Anything podcast. If you subscribe to the Unbelievable podcast, you may well be interested in this one as well, in which I sit down every couple of weeks with leading New Testament Bible scholar Tom Wright to simply ask him questions that people send in. You simply need to register at the website asknt.com and you'll receive a link to be able to ask questions, and indeed you'll be added to our newsletter with loads of brilliant updates and interesting articles, videos and so on. But the podcast is where we ask the questions, and recently I asked him a question about Christmas. It seemed appropriate with Christmas approaching to talk about the historical Jesus, yes, and the Gospels. We've had a lot of questions in on this, something you've obviously done a great, sure, deal of work on yourself. And sticking with the Christmas theme, one thing I've often been asked by skeptics who aren't convinced about the Gospels' historical reliability is how we should treat the birth narratives, right, particularly in Matthew and Luke,
right, right,
shepherds, wise men, yeah, and yeah, so on. Yeah.
a lot of people claim that they were essentially invented after the fact as a sort of way of giving Jesus a sort of royal arrival on the scene, as it were. Right. What's your view on those kind of criticisms?
Yeah, let me just tell you a little story about that to show where our culture is sitting on that. About 15, 20 years ago, I was phoned up shortly before Christmas by a television station saying they were putting together a program which was going to talk about the birth narratives, and they wanted a New Testament specialist to come on and say, actually, probably that stuff never actually happened. And this was just a researcher on the phone. And I said, supposing I was to come on and say, actually, there's quite a reasonable chance that it might have done. And there was a pause. And then she said, I don't think that's what my producer was looking for. So I said, thank you, goodbye. But, you know, that's how our culture is slanted right now. They don't want to hear that actually, I'm an ancient historian. I study texts in which most of the incidents that we know about in the ancient world are described once and once only. That's how you get from Tacitus or Suetonius or any of the other great writers. And even Josephus, the great Jewish historian, who tells the same story in the Antiquities, then he does the small version in the Jewish War, and a bit of it as well in his autobiography. Quite often, he's talking about things only once. That doesn't mean it didn't happen. And he is, of course, writing it all 20, 30 years later, some cases even more than that. But historians have to say, well, that's a bit of evidence. How do we weigh that? Mm-hmm. What's the probability? What's the likelihood, etc.? And so the danger then is that some Christians say, well, because the Bible is inspired, we must believe that it all happened exactly as so. And I want to say, well, yes, I am happy to say that the Bible is the book that God has given us, and I live with that. But if I am making an argument to a fellow ancient historian who isn't a believer, I think I will say, well, you know perfectly well, there's lots of things that happened that you would write into your books, which are only in one in one story and may well have been written up 100 years later. So when we're talking about shepherds, well, yes, that's in principle probable, possible, depending on what you think about angels. Likewise, when you're talking about wise men, depending on what you think about comets and so on. And of course, there's been a lot of work done on what star or comet it was, and some quite interesting stuff. I haven't followed all the recent research on that, but people have said you can actually pinpoint some things which might help you date when that's going on. So I want to say, from the point of view of making a case to a non-believer, I would say keep an open mind on that. Stuff happens.
Right.
Interesting, having slagged off one particular broadcaster, the BBC some years ago did a Christmas thing, I think it was a six-part or something, 20-minute or half-hour programs, where they'd got the guy who did the script for EastEnders.
That's right.
And they gave him the Christmas stories and said, do it. It was spectacular.
It was very good.
And it was thoroughly believable.
Yes.
It made sense as a narrative. And I thought people need to see that, because making sense is what history is supposed to do.
Well, I know you've written books on Advent and so on, so do go and check those out if you want some reading ahead of the Christmas season itself. But let's turn to some of the questions that have come in generally on the historical Jesus and the Gospels, Tom. Here's one. And I'll ask you to be as brief as this person asks you to be. JD in Los Angeles says, what would you say is the most straightforward, succinct way to explain the historical accuracy of the Gospels?
Oh, and you'd love to know what he said in response to that listener question, wouldn't you? Well, if you want to know what Tom Wright said in response to that particular question and a number of others that we cover on the latest edition of the Ask NT Wright Anything podcast, questions around Bart Ehrman and biblical authority, the Ascension, all kinds of other things, do go and download it. Just look in your podcast provider for Ask NT Wright Anything. And do get registered at the website asknt.com to be able to ask questions of your own and to get all the bonus content, competition prizes and all sorts of other good stuff that we've launched with this new podcast. Hope you enjoyed that that Christmas question that I asked Tom. And here are some other people who have appreciated the launch of this new podcast. One person in the USA says this is audio gold. Another says fantastic first show. Love the topics. My only complaint is I'm hoping for longer episodes. 30 minutes, just not enough time. This one says, the only bad thing about this podcast is I can't yet listen to more episodes. Tom and Justin have had such a large impact on my theological shifts in recent years. Wonderful to have a place where hard theological questions can be discussed and presented. And this one says, I've been wondering for years why Tom Wright doesn't have his own podcast. I'm so glad it's finally here, and with Justin in a Q&A format. Fantastic. And this one says, so good to have N.T. Wright's pithy insights, his clarity and depth much needed in today's theological landscape. So just a few of the people who've left reviews on that podcast appreciating that new one. It's been riding high in the UK religion and spirituality podcast charts. I know it's done well as well in Canada and USA and Australia and other places. So if you're not yet subscribed and it's your cup of tea, do go and get hold of it. Just a few emails to finish off before we have to conclude today's Christmas edition of Unbelievable. Speaking of Bible historians, Jed gets in touch following the re-airing of that Bart Ehrman and Peter J. Williams debate on the textual transmission of the New Testament. Says, thank you for your commitment to dialogue with ideas and criticism of the Christian faith. And listening to the debate between Bart Ehrman and Peter J. Williams, I'm wondering why Bart argues that Jesus being angry in Mark's gospel is so different to him showing compassion. I'd say they're both the same. Bart believes that he's angry at the leper. If so, why did he heal him? Well, compassion, of course. It's obvious that given Jesus having compassion in countless other references, that he is a man of compassion, but it's possible to link anger with compassion. You bet. If I see someone being bullied and abused, you bet I get angry. And coupled with that, have compassion for the person. I don't know if Bart has been in contact with someone, a human being who is God's creation, being eaten away by Mycobacterium leprae. It's a memory that you can't forget. And if you were the creator of all that is seen, it would make you angry. Bart's argument that they're different is unbelievable. I find it unbelievable that Bart Ehrman fails to understand that written text was a minor form of preserving the Jesus story in the first century, plus that oral tradition, which was a daily event, a continual source of correction. Thank you very much, Jed, for your views on that. If you want to remind yourself of the particular issue that was at stake there that Jed is referring to, go back to that show of a few weeks ago, Bart Ehrman and Peter J. Williams debating Bart's book, Misquoting Jesus. This one came in from Birmingham, a big fan of the show, who says, wondering whether you might be able to help with quite a specific problem proposed by a client of mine. I'm a personal trainer, and he reminds me how much he enjoys the theological component of our sessions. His issue is basically around suffering, but it's subtly twofold. Firstly, why would God create beings that would ultimately be capable of perpetrating such atrocious horrors as found in the Holocaust? He carries a profound empathy towards the Jewish people and raises this often. And secondly, why would he create beings that were ill-equipped to behave in a way that was right and pleasing to him? Like asking a dyslexic child to stand up and read Shakespeare. It seems cruel. He isn't really interested in the moral argument. We've had that discussion many times, i.e. how you ground human rights and dignity, for which I'd immediately turn to Andy Bannister. He also has fundamental problems with the concept of original sin, although that's possibly tainted by his strict Catholic upbringing. On the face of it, he also rejects the perspective of how Jesus demonstrates his benevolence towards a suffering world by dying on the cross. For those arguments, I'd turn to John Lennox, by claiming his suffering can't be equated with those whose experience isn't grounded in some ultimate purpose or reason for their suffering, like that of Jesus. So the heart of this issue, as far as I can see, seems to be more to do with the philosophy of free will in the context of suffering. Was it right for God to make us free if the results would be so, in his eyes, catastrophic? I've attempted to go through previous debates myself to find an answer, particularly those with John Lennox, but I'm sure there is a specific debate where the atheist opponent raises the problems created by the free will argument, and the two have a good chance to work through the issues. Short of wading through hours of your old podcast, I was wondering whether you could point me in the direction of any episodes or perhaps other resources that speak into this problem and might perhaps delve into some of the surrounding ones at the same time. Thanks, as always, for your great work. Thank you very much for that. Came in via Facebook. I'm so glad to hear, firstly, that you're having such great conversations with someone when you're obviously doing the fitness and training thing with them. I sometimes wonder how many people in the gym are actually listening to Unbelievable. I know at least a few Unbelievable listeners for whom that's the point at which they get their weekly intake. The link I've actually sent to you in response to the question of whether there's any episodes that might speak into this was actually one which I did myself with David Smalley, if you remember that show from getting on for 6 or 7 months ago now, where I sort of debated directly with David, who runs his own atheist podcast, this whole question of evil, suffering, free will. That was where a lot of our conversation revolved around. And I'm of the opinion that there is a good free will defense for why God would allow a certain amount of suffering
even though it's a terrible evil, that it's, as it were, worth it for the sake of the freedom that we do get. But that freedom comes with constraints, comes with the fact that people will do things. And we live in a world, if you like, where things will go wrong. Now, the question is the free will worth it? Well, I think ultimately, yes, it is. I guess I would rather liken it to the parent who chooses to bring a child into the world, fully knowing that that child will experience suffering at some point in their life, pain, will die eventually. And yet, why do we choose to do that as parents? Because we believe that the experience of love, of family, of life is enough to warrant that. That's a choice we make in bringing people into the world. For me, I think something similar happens with God. I think it's worth it. The downside of the love that we experience is the fact that we people can be unloving, but nonetheless, it's worth it for the sake of love. In any case, great to hear that you are having those kinds of conversations. Thank you very much for getting in touch. And one final one from Jim, who wants to get in touch about that show we had a few weeks ago now, Austin Fisher on doubt. And Jim says, thanks for another interesting episode. I know this will sound arrogant, but I have a hard time understanding how people can doubt God's existence, at least a God who's responsible for the natural world. It seems so obvious to me. Here's my reasoning. If there is a beginning to the natural world, and if the first event in the natural world has a cause, then the cause of that event could not be natural. I don't see how there can be any doubt with any substance to it that the natural world began to exist, considering our experience tells us that such would be the case, and that all the scientific evidence to date points to it, not to mention the logical problem of an infinite regress. So to doubt a first event would be to go against our experience, all the scientific evidence to date, and logic as well. So the only real options left, as far as I can tell, are either the first event had no cause, which seems intuitively absurd and goes against the principle of sufficient reason, or the first event caused itself to exist, which again would be a logical contradiction, or the first event came about from nothing, which again is totally absurd, or something other than a cause related to the natural world was responsible for the first event. Now, the last option is the only one that really makes any sense at all, and I don't see how this could be subjective. It just seems like an objective truth, regardless of how many brilliant philosophers come up with all kinds of lame attempts at arguing otherwise. Of course, this doesn't get you to Christianity, but I think once the myth of naturalism is debunked, the evidence that I've seen for the truth of Christianity, in particular the resurrection, is very hard to deny. But to doubt the existence of a God who created the natural world just seems to be to leave logic and reason behind and float off into a directionless search to what reality is all about. I know that seems arrogant, but I just can't see how it could be any other way, despite all the attempts by amazingly smart people to argue otherwise. Sorry for rambling on. I do enjoy your programme a lot, especially that it gets me thinking more deeply about what I believe. Thank you, Jim. Well, it sounds obviously to me, Jim, like you're absolutely feel that the what's often called the argument from a first cause, first mover, the cosmological argument, as Leibniz put it, is obviously something that for you seems an absolute slam dunk as far as evidence needed that God is there from a philosophical perspective. So, yeah, I guess there's just a lot of people for whom that argument does not carry the same weight that you see it as. I personally, I'm obviously very sympathetic. I think that when you kind of get down to the bedrock of why is there anything at all, it seems to me that we do need an explanation that goes beyond a material explanation. As the classic argument from contingency puts it, if all other things in this world are contingent, they have to have their source in something that is not contingent. And it appears that God is the best explanation, in my view, for what that source could be. But thank you very much. So many interesting emails that I get to leaf through on a regular basis, and you're welcome to send in yours. Welcome to send in your thoughts as well for subjects you'd like to see us cover in 2019 as well, as the end of the year approaches soon. For the moment, thanks for being with me on the show today, and let me tell you what's coming up on the final show of 2018.
You're unbelievable.
We'll be charting the unlikely friendship that grew up between international evangelist Kevin Pillau, who's the son of famed evangelist Lewis Pillau, and Portland's secular gay mayor, Sam Adams. Kevin tells that story in his book, Unlikelier, about the way that putting aside their differences to make a difference in Portland was the beginning of a great friendship in which they learned an awful lot about each other along the way. We'll be hearing them both on Unbelievable this time next week. I think it's a good one to end the year on, a story about a conversation between between friends. So do come back if you can for the podcast, for the radio show. For now, have a great week and a very happy Christmas. You've been listening to The Unbelievable Podcast. Help others find the show by rating and reviewing us in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts from. And discover more shows from Premier at premier.org.uk/podcasts.